Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people I know who are more committed, more engaged, and more effective in one of the most important battle spaces in that war than our first guest. She is Brigitte Gabriel. She is the founder of Act for America and its leader now for quite a number of years, the author of numerous books, including They Must Be Stopped, Why We Must Defeat Radical Islam and How We Can Do It. She is a good friend, not infrequent, but not as frequent a guest on this program as I'd like, but it's because she's so busy trying to secure our country against Sharia supremacism, as I think of it, and she's a great ally in that cause. So, Brigitte, welcome. It's so good to have you. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you, my friend. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I wanted to start with something you've been commenting on, as have we, a very troubling development. You've touched on it in the title of the book I mentioned, Radical Islam. As you know, President Trump ran on a promise that he was going not only to name radical Islamic terrorism as the threat we face, but he was going to defeat it. We haven't heard that term from him lately, Brigitte. What do you make of it? And what are the implications of him seemingly having deviated from naming the enemy?
Well, I think the greatest disappointment so far since President Trump became president was basically this day on 9/11. For a president or candidate Trump who ran using the words radical Islamic terrorism and how we're going to fight radical Islamic terrorism and how we're going to bring them to justice, for the first day at the first September 11th memorial service where he speaks as president, the fact that he failed to mention or utter those words was just a great disappointment for the base who worked very hard to elect candidate Trump, who became president based on the fact that he was not politically correct. He was the one person who was unpredictable, was not a part of the establishment, who can speak what's on his mind and what everybody believed will stand up for the average patriotic American and finally say what needs to be said.
You've made your life's work to help the rest of us understand how important it is to recognize and call out and counter this supremacist Islamic ideology of Sharia. You come from Lebanon. You had a lot of firsthand exposure of the very hardest kind to it. So I know this is a passion of yours and I think is of the American voters who did, in fact, give Donald Trump a mandate, I think, in no small measure on this promise. So, Brigitte, what is your assessment of why he has stopped using this term?
This is so scary to even think or even utter these words, that we are basically dealing with the continuation of the Obama policy under a new name.
Obama's third term.
Exactly. And it's sad because you have a lot of the Obama leftovers who are now basically advising the presidents and advising the presidents on national security. So when you look at how far the Trump presidency has changed from the beginning, where you had General Flynn, you had Steve Bannon, you had Rich Higgins, you had all these strong national security advisors and experts who actually knew what they were dealing with. Today, all these people are out. Sebastian Gorka, a lot of the colleagues, Frank, that you and I work with and admire and respect and do know that they actually have true knowledge of the enemy we are fighting. All these people are out.
And who's there instead?
Yeah, so you now have McMaster, you have Kelly, you have Mattis, you have all these people who basically come from 8 years of a politically correct education about what we call radical Islam. What they call is basically a handful of extremists who do not represent Islam, who have hijacked Islam.
Yeah, who have nothing to do with it, as a matter of fact. Yeah. You know, this is interesting, Brigitte. The only thing I would quibble about is I'm afraid that it perhaps was true of the previous 8 years pretty much as well as the Obama years. But it was certainly most of these people made their chops, made their stars, as in the case of the general officers, at least during the Obama administration, where this was indeed the mantra. But I want to switch gears. You were pulled together rallies across the United States to stand up for free speech, which is very much in the crosshairs now of not only the Sharia supremacists who don't want anything that is contrary to their Sharia blasphemy laws, including our First Amendment rights, but also their enablers on the left, and I guess in some quarters of the Republican Party as well. What happened to those rallies and why?
We had 67 rallies scheduled in 36 states across the country, basically to commemorate 9/11. They were on the weekend of 9/11. They were that Saturday before 9/11, the weekend of 9/11, to basically honor the memory of the victims who died because of terrorism, to celebrate America's exceptionalism, to express and exercise our freedom of speech. And we had to cancel that. And we wanted to express our opinion about strong national security policy, specifically when we started seeing that there are some changes taking place in the Trump administration, and we wanted to make sure our voice is heard. Unfortunately, we had to cancel these rallies, not because of threats from ISIS, but because of threats from the radical left within our country, like Antifa and Black Lives Matter, who threatened to exercise the same tactics of ISIS by basically driving cars and mowing down our people, as well as bringing knives and machetes and slashing our people. And we could not take that risk to basically risk the lives of young families, mothers and fathers, showing up with their children on a Saturday afternoon waving the American flag.
Brigitte Gabriel, let me just ask you, because this is so chilling, and I'm afraid not isolated incidents, even 67 of them. This is fitting a pattern brought to us by a group, an alliance, an unholy alliance that you've studied closely, as have I, between these jihadists, the Sharia supremacists, if you will, on the one hand, and those on the hard left. And so whether it's, the Council on American Islamic Relations or, the other Muslim Brotherhood fronts in this country or, their partners, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the rest, or whether it's Antifa, as you say, an Answer coalition and others on the radical left, it doesn't matter. They're exercising effectively a heckler's veto that really does restrict freedom of speech, our most fundamental of freedoms, it seems to me. And I wanted to ask you one other thing about this, if I could, very quickly. There's action on the Congress part as well. There was a resolution, a joint resolution adopted in both the Senate and House this week that kind of sets the stage for more of this restricting of hate speech, as they call it, and hate groups. You've been called that, as have I, by the Southern Poverty Law Center and others. Brigitte Gabriel, what are your thoughts as you're watching this kind of agenda move through the Congress of the United States, not just out in the streets of America?
This is war, and this is war declared on patriotic Americans by the leftist and the Islamic Alliance coming together to silence us, because that's the only way they can succeed. And this is something that we are organizing right now, Frank, that we are going to fight tooth and nail, because when they start naming in Congress resolutions against people like you and me, who we are called as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which basically is their opinion. And their opinion is shaped in great part by care. I mean, when I read what the Southern Poverty Law Center writes about you and me, we are literally reading the CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, press release almost verbatim.
Amen. Brigitte, this is a topic to which we will have to return soon. We are out of time, but I thank you for your leadership on this. I know your team is working with mine in Warsaw, Poland, as we speak, where the European Union and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and others are trying to move forward this agenda of silencing people here in America, as well as overseas, and in this case, in our country, despite our First Amendment freedoms. We are so proud of what you do to defend them, and we look forward to working with you in the future in that regard. Next up, we'll speak with Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller about what's happening on Capitol Hill with that scandalous IT story. Debbie Wasserman Schultz and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest for this segment is one of the great investigative reporters in America today. His name is Richard Pollack. He is, by title, the senior investigative reporter for a terrific organization founded by Tucker Carlson, now of Fox News fame, called The Daily Caller. He has a lot of experience doing this sort of work in various other media organizations. He was the Washington bureau chief for another terrific online resource, PJ Media. He was a Washington producer for Good Morning America and a senior producer for Tony Snow at Fox News Sunday. One of our favorite guests and always welcome. Thank you so much for joining us again. Richard, good to have you back.
Thank you, Frank.
I won't get into it in detail on this occasion, but I did want to just say thank you. A real shout out is in order, it seems to me, for the work your investigative unit is doing, usually under the byline of Luke Rosiak, digging into, exploring, exposing, and helping the rest of us understand this really just unbelievably outrageous scandal involving House Democrats and their use of IT professionals, as we're calling them, hailing from Pakistan. It's a very complicated story, but I just wanted to say a personal hat tip to you and the team you lead, Richard, because I think we're not to the end of that one by any means, and I know you'll keep up the great reporting work you're doing on it, but you've really helped make this story a national focus of attention at long last, and it wouldn't have happened without your good leadership and Luke's great reporting.
Let me just say, Frank, that the tip of the hat to Luke for sure. He got onto the story very much like the Watergate investigation, where there was a third-rate burglary. He looked at this, the firing of four Pakistani brothers from a Capitol Police blotter item, and wondered, why are these four people who are in the IT department being fired? Why are they under arrest? Why are they being interviewed? What's here? And I don't think no one else looked at that story. And Luke looked into it. He began digging. He has done a relentless job, and he has uncovered what is perhaps potentially one of the real cybersecurity scandals of 2016 and even earlier.
And we don't even really know the full dimensions of it yet. Richard, you have done some important reporting on a problem that I really think of as kind of the central challenge of our time, at least at the moment, here in the United States, as well as in Europe and Canada and other parts of the free world, namely the assault that is being mounted against freedom of speech. Name-calling is the least of it. Smearing people, reporters, as well as folks like us. This is now considered to be part and parcel of the public policy debate these days, alas. But what's more worrying to me is that we're seeing corporations and various philanthropic entities and merchant banking organizations, as well as folks on Capitol Hill, now starting to fall in line with groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League to essentially snuff free speech, at least if it's critical of their agendas. Would you shed light, as you see it, on how serious a problem this is and its serious manifestations?
Well, Frank, I think this is probably one of the most serious challenges to a free society. After all, we are still a unique nation in that people are allowed to think and to speak their minds without any sense of fear or intimidation. That's what makes America special, and I think it's what makes America great. And the slippery slope toward totalitarianism is when we're told that there is what's something called politically correct speech, which we've heard about for a long time, when we have large organizations such as Google and Facebook that attempt to regulate speech from their point of view, thereby censoring certain types of ideas that they deem unworthy, to, as you mentioned, the attempt to try to use sort of McCarthyism, that is, some association as a reason why we should not seriously engage in conversation with certain groups. So the Southern Poverty Law Center is an organization that originally was supposed to, actually they were a civil rights group that sort of lost their way. The civil rights acts of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Acts were passed. There was desegregation going on, and suddenly they didn't have a mission any longer, but things were really moving in a very positive way. So they decided to become a specialist on hate groups. And the problem is that their definition of hate groups, which was at one point very tight and clear, has now become very broad and very inclusive to include anybody who has a point of view that is different than the liberal litmus test is now a hate group.
Or a hater, or a racist, or a bigot, or an extremist. I mean, you pick your slander, but the truth of the matter is they're applying it for, I believe, political warfare purposes. And I just wonder, Richard, late last month, you did an important piece about a man who is often behind with his philanthropy, if not in other more directive ways, a lot of this kind of activity, and that would be the billionaire known as George Soros. Talk a little bit about your reporting on Soros and the kind of role that he's playing in this political warfare of our time.
Well, there are a number of billionaires, which probably Soros is the kingpin. And that is, these are people who do not believe in a free market economy, which is ironic for Soros because that's how he's won his wealth, but who are basically socialist at heart, in my opinion, who do not believe in free markets, do not believe, I think, also in freedom of speech and freedom of the press, unless, of course, they're writing the politically correct kinds of things. And so Soros has created, is behind a group called the Democratic Alliance. Of course, we have to use the word democratic. That's like when you hear about East Germany, it was the People's Republic.
Yeah, the Democratic People's Republic, right? In North Korea, for example, and interestingly enough, as you say that, you know, open societies is another of those euphemisms, the brand for one of his largest philanthropic operations. Anything but open societies, except I guess with respect to our open borders.
That's right. The abuse of our language is for some of those who are old enough to remember Orwellian, where there is you know, right is wrong and black is white, and we're seeing that from a portion of the political left, I think, at this point. And it is wholly destructive to a society when certain thoughts are considered permitted and other thoughts are not. And Soros has been very much behind that. But I had an article just recently about George Soros in which we discovered that his financial ownership or stakes in different companies are not very politically correct. So, he, you know, he's invested in oil companies, despite his claim for being concerned about global warming. He owns tobacco companies. He owns fast food companies like Wendy's. He even, you know, the left is very concerned and others about genetically modified foods. Well, he has had a longstanding investment in Monsanto and other GMO producing companies, too.
And you actually have firearms there in the mix as well, a guy who's been trying to disarm Americans for generations. There's so much more here, Richard Pollack. We are hard out of time, unfortunately. It goes by so quickly when we're talking with you. You do tremendously important work in your own right, of course, as well as through your leadership of Luke and the rest of your team. I appreciate the chance to visit with you from time to time and hope that you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz. We'll get our weekly tour inside the ring with another great investigative reporter right after this. Welcome back. We have the pleasure of the company of another great investigative and national security reporter. He is Bill Gertz. He is the prize-winning author of the Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times. He's also the senior editor of yet another very important online resource, the Washington Free Beacon. The author of seven, count them, seven best-selling books, including the most recent, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it is so good to have you with us. You've been reporting up a storm on things involving our interest in Asia, both the Pacific, China, and not least now in space as well. I'm anxious to talk with you about all of them. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Always great to be on the show.
Well, let's take note of the fact that there is going to be a new commander of the U.S. Pacific Command heading out into what are indisputably troubled waters these days. We'll talk a little bit about what's on his portfolio, but what do we know about Admiral Scott Swift, who will be replacing Harry Harris in that job?
Yeah, this is the lead item in my weekly Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times this week, and it looks at basically a done deal. And the deal was that Admiral Harris, the current PACOM commander, was offered a second three-year term at Camp Smith in Honolulu and turned it down. And instead, he is going to be named as the U.S. ambassador to Australia as part of a strategy to try to get some really good people in ambassadorial slots, people who understand the China threat and are willing to help the allies to deal with it. That said, the Pacific Fleet commander, that is Admiral Scott Swift, has got the nod. And when the transition will take place, it will depend on Harris getting the nod for the ambassadorship. If that happens, then we could see a speed up of Swift coming in. He's a good guy. The people who worked for him tell me that he's well respected as both a thinker and a warrior. And one of the things that he was able to do was to break the international dateline divide within the Navy. That was the line that kept the continental-based naval forces from working in the Western Pacific. And he was able to get those Eastern forces to be part of the growing military presence in the Pacific, specifically because of the growing Chinese threat.
Yeah. Interesting and important development there. But Bill, you followed these guys so closely for so long. I don't know whether it's something in the water in Honolulu where these bases are, or whether it's the nature of the promotion system and the political interventions in it. But it certainly seems as though we've had a string of commanders in that position, SINCPAC, they used to call it, and now the commander of the Pacific Command, who have, well, I don't know whether they've gone native or are panda huggers, as some have said, but they certainly have been more inclined to accommodate the Chinese than to resist them. If that's a fair characterization, where would you expect Admiral Swift to come down?
Definitely more on the side of Admiral Harris, who had a much tougher posture towards China. He was the one that came out and called Chinese aggression, and let's be honest, that's what it is, the Great Wall of Sand. I think that we'll see Admiral Swift in that same mold. Yeah, it's true that the Navy in particular has been heavily politicized on China, and this has developed, especially under the Obama administration, where this notion of building trust through military exchanges became the centerpiece of the policy there and created all kinds of politicization. I can remember Admiral Locklear saying that it wasn't China or North Korea that was the biggest threat in the Pacific. It was climate change.
Yeah, global warming. I remember that too. Hey, Bill, you've pointed out that in some measure, this is a function of a very much a one-way to military relationship, and we need no more of that for sure. Bill, we've got to run out of time before we run out of topics with you. I'd like to do sort of a lightning round on a couple of other stories you've been reporting on that all have something to do with China. Chinese trucks in North Korea. This is really an ongoing story, but what's the latest on it?
Yeah, this is new information that was one of the regular panel of experts reports out of the United Nations. Under one of the Security Council resolutions, there's a panel of experts that looks at the North Korean missile and sanctions issues. And this one was pretty mind-blowing in a lot of sense, especially when you consider it was produced by a UN panel of experts that included a Chinese national. And it basically revealed that additional information about Chinese military support to the missile program of North Korea, in this case, some trucks by a company called Sinotruk that were sold and were just photographed in April carrying the brand new submarine-launched KN-11 submarine-launched ballistic missile. Of course, the Chinese dissembled and lied about it to the UN. They said that, well, actually, there's no prohibition on selling these trucks, when in fact there is. They were converted into military trucks, sold as civilian trucks, converted into military trucks. And that's, again, the Chinese excuse. They need to be sanctioned. Trump administration has not sanctioned him for an even more egregious transfer, which was the mobile transporter erector launchers, which are now used for the long-range missiles, the nuclear missiles.
The one pointed at us. These are not friends, it's fair to say, Bill Gertz, and they're not people that we can rely upon to curb the dangerous appetite and threats posed by these North Korean proxies, are they? Let me ask you, Bill, quickly about space. We had Steve Lambakis of the National Institute for Public Policy on the program earlier this week, did a terrific job talking about the challenges in space. That's the subject of a new report that you've highlighted for us and others. You've been particularly keen on what they found in that NIPP study about what you call a great leap forward in terms of Chinese military space activities, as well as some that may be dual use. Talk about that, Bill.
Sure. This was a really eye-opening report and by the National Institute for Public Policy. And while it identified other foreign space threats, clearly the Chinese are making major strides in developing this asymmetric strategic warfare capability. In a sense, the blinding of satellites with lasers, four types of direct ascent anti-satellite missiles. And in fact, the report highlights the use of nuclear blasts in space to create electromagnetic or EMP pulse attacks against satellites. All this is designed as asymmetric warfare in the opening stages of any future conflict with the United States, and it really highlights the key vulnerability.
Bill, you have done such great work on this, including, among other things, highlighting the two Chinese People's Liberation Army colonels who wrote about unrestricted warfare back in the day when they were mostly using non-kinetic means to threaten us. These are now combining with a whole array, as you say, of kinetic ones in space and terrestrial as well. Hey, Bill, quickly, lastly, when we spoke last week, you mentioned to me that there was an interesting story involving this Chinese billionaire who has sought refuge in our country, Guo Wengui. Would you tell us what is the story there?
Yeah, this is a major story of a Chinese billionaire who has broken with the regime and has begun revealing secrets about high-level corruption and corruption at the highest levels, literally within the seven-member standing committee of the Politburo. He's been under pressure from the Chinese to have him return to China. They've trumped up charges against him. he's living in New York and battling back. I think he's has the potential to be a Alexander Solzhenitsyn-like figure for the Chinese in really pressing for reform. So I'm very optimistic if the pro-China factions within government here don't turn him back over. He has a real potential to make some positive changes in the Chinese political system.
If the Chinese don't kill him, which is another distinct possibility as well, even in this country, I'm afraid. Bill Gertz, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We appreciate tremendously, as always, your visits with us, but as well, your reporting and your terrific books, including most recently, IWAR, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, thanks so much. Come back to us again soon. Have a great weekend. Next up, we will speak with Jessica Vaughn. We'll talk with her about the latest in the DACA drama. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by the remarkable Jessica Vaughn. I say remarkable because she is the director of policy studies at an organization I highly esteem, the Center for Immigration Studies. She also is remarkable because of her background as, of all things, a Foreign Service officer. And she's one very squared away Foreign Service officer, now specializing, of course, in matters involving immigration, which, of course, are of enormous importance to the national security. We're always delighted to have her with us. Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be with you.
Listen, there's so much to talk about because there's so many of these stories that are just, well, I'm thinking Hurricane Irma at the moment. I know you served in the Foreign Service in the Caribbean, so I know you have a feeling for what that's like to the people exposed to these hurricanes. But talk a little bit about DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, the various stories we're being told, the various contrasting and conflicting explanations for what's going on. First of all, you know, how important is it that we get this sorted out? And are we any closer to doing that at the moment than we were a week ago?
I think it is important that it gets sorted out eventually, but I don't think it is of economic importance or, you know, in the long run and big picture, really critical to our nation that we find a solution for these 700,000 to 800,000 people who have this dubious status that President Obama gave them in an abuse of executive authority. So it really, in the greater scheme of things, isn't of huge importance to our nation, but I think it's of political importance to President Trump and to the Republicans in Congress that something be worked out, because it's an opportunity to make needed fixes to our immigration system if they don't blow it.
And that's what I want to ask you about. But before we do, just a further explanation of the stakes here. It's been pointed out on our program, among other places, Jessica, and I think by you as a matter of fact, that one of the questions that needs to be sorted out properly is who exactly is going to benefit from what amounts to an amnesty for these, they're called children, but most of them are not, of course. They may have been at one point when they came here with their parents illegally, but most of them are considerably older than that now. Are their parents and possibly others in their extended family likely to be eligible for this amnesty as well, if we're not very careful about structuring this this deal properly?
Yes, is the short answer. And I think it's important to remember that, first of all, despite the picture that's painted of them by the news media and the anti-borders people, let's call them, this is not some group of best and brightest individuals in the world that we're, you know, allowing to stay in the United States. This is a group of, frankly, ordinary illegal aliens who are different because they arrived as children. And so there's somewhat of a special case just only because they didn't themselves make the choice to come here.
But in fairness, some of them are probably in a normal distribution. Some of them are probably very bright, very capable, very hardworking. Some of them are not. And, you know, it's your point, I think, is they weren't selected to come to this country because they're really bright or because they've done extraordinarily well in school and so on. Some have, some haven't. All right. So let's talk, Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Immigration Studies, about what the Republicans on Capitol Hill, as well as Donald Trump, need to do to get this right, to make the kinds of changes that are needed for immigration policy more generally. Are you advocating now a sort of Gang of Eight comprehensive immigration reform program done at one fell swoop that will fix the DACA situation, among others?
No, although, as you pointed out just a second ago, it's clear that the Democrats and certain people on the high immigration right, like Lindsey Graham, Jeff Flake, people like that, would love to turn this into the son of Gang of Eight and turn it into a bigger amnesty for more people and other things that they'd like to accomplish with token enforcement measures, and that's what we have to avoid. There is a better solution, and what we need to get right is to have if there is to be an amnesty, and I think that's very much up for grabs, may not happen because there's people in the House opposed to it, but if there's going to be one, it should be only for most of the people who already have DACA, the benefit that Obama extended to them. Because they've been identified, screened, and you know, laxly, but still, it's a discrete group of people. This cannot become a permanent rolling amnesty for anybody who gets here when they're a child.
Or even chain migration for those whose families are likely to find a child getting permanent status, right?
Exactly. And that's the first thing that would need to be mitigated. If anyone is to agree to such a deal, it has to be offset by some more limits on chain migration so that the people who did make the decision to come here, these parents, are not able to benefit through the amnesty for their kids. So that's the first thing that should be part of any deal.
So let's talk about a couple of the other things. Let's get on the table here the importance, as you see it, of E-Verify. I think I spoke with your boss, Mark Krikorian, about this the other day, and he stressed this as a really top priority. Then there's also this wall business. Interestingly enough, Jessica, I'd like you to respond to this. Congressman Chris Stewart, who espouses some sort of deal on DACA, by the way, was on our program last couple of days and talked about his willingness to condition DACA arrangements codified in law, not with some seed funding to begin building a wall, but with the completion of the wall, which is a sort of interesting twist on this. Would you talk about those two and how you see they have to be sorted out in this future arrangement that is in the national interest, not just the interest of the Republican Party?
Yes, ideally robust enforcement, both at the border and in terms of deterring illegal hiring, should be a prerequisite for any amnesty, because we know from past history that amnesty, or even the talk of amnesty, jumpstarts illegal immigration and causes a surge of people trying to get here, to get under. They don't know the details. They just know that there's going to be an amnesty and they want to get here to take advantage of it. That's what happened after DACA was implemented. So it would be ideal if enforcement could be shored up before an amnesty happens. I'm not sure that we have that possibility here because of the six-month deadline that President Trump has given to Congress to fix this. So, but that would be ideal. But barring that, if we can't get the one thing that has happened is immigration enforcement officers are now allowed to do their job, and that helps a lot. If we can't get the wall finished in time, then we need to impose something like E-Verify or other versions of strict workplace compliance to prevent illegal hiring, because that's what's going to deter people from coming over the long term. And that's what's going to help us have a system with some integrity. So, it would be nice to get them, but we should try to get at least E-Verify along with this. And frankly, I think House Republicans have the stronger hand in terms of negotiating. I'm not sure they realize it.
Or are willing to play it is the bigger problem, it seems. The leadership having demonstrated rather assiduously, I think it's fair to say, that they are not actually interested in helping secure these borders. It's kind of unbelievable, especially since they keep running for office, promising to do just that. Jessica Fawn, we have to leave it at that for the moment. It's always bracing to talk with you. Your insights and your understanding of these issues, as well as the clarity with which you talk about them, is extremely valuable, as is the work of your organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. Check it out, folks, at cis.org. I'd also ask you, Jessica, to come back to us again soon and to say to the rest of you, do the same, please, on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.